Welcome to The Resilient Recruiter. My name is Mark Whitby. My special guest today is David Perry. David is the managing director of Perry Martell International, which was a business founded in 1988, which David founded with his partner, Anita Martell. They're based in Ottawa. Their firm has completed over 1,400 projects worth a combined total in salaries of $393 million. They place executives in technology, real estate, construction, and have been featured in a lot of media, including Fortune Magazine, Inc. Magazine, Wall Street Journal, HuffPost, Washington Post, and many other media outlets. David is a recruiter. He's also a job search coach. He's an author. He's a sought-after motivational speaker. He's the author, in fact, of 7 books, which are Hiring Greatness, Executive Recruiting for Dummies, I think that would include me, Guerrilla Marketing for Job Hunters, and he was presented with the Queen Elizabeth II Diamond Jubilee Medal for Community Service. So, David, thank you for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm going to hire you to do the intros from now on. This is great. My face red. I can feel it here, but anyway.
Oh, great. Well, you've had a long and...
Here we go. Okay.
All right. Excellent. So, David, you're from Quebec City, which is a beautiful city. I'm actually from Halifax, Nova Scotia.
So I've swam the dingle many a day.
Oh, have you? Oh, wow. Yeah. That's hilarious. Nobody else listening besides the two of us will have any clue where the dingle is. So listen, I decided I'm going to put this out on July 1st. So happy Canada Day.
Thank you.
So listen, you were referred to me by Rich Rosen. How do you know Rich?
Do I have to tell?
Well, not if you're going to say anything that will incriminate you.
Yeah, I think it would incriminate both of us. We're both hard-charging headhunters, and I don't remember where we first met. It may have been the Herc. It may have just been online. He may have commented on something that I commented on, you know, sort of whacked me up the side of the head, and I probably beat him back after I ripped his leg off, and beat him with his own leg. So that's how these relationships start, typically, right, for recruiters?
So you met him on Facebook or something?
Probably.
Okay. All right. Interesting. Well, listen, the combined salaries of the searches your firm has filled, $393 million, that's kind of mind-boggling. What does that work out to in placement fees? It must be around $100 million or so.
God, I wish I charged 33% on all of them. Truth be known, when I started, my first couple months as a recruiter back in 88 were a little harrowing because I came out of a firm that I'd been with for almost 2 years. And my second year there, I stayed 9 months. And in my second year, in those 9 months, I billed $758,000. That's not bad for 1988 in construction and real estate. But I went out on my own, and my boss, you know, immediately sued me and sent me a letter. Now, here's the interesting part. Sent me a letter to let me know that he was going to sue me if I went after any of my clients. So I didn't. I didn't. I actually, when I resigned on the Friday, I worked the next 2 weeks, and he immediately locked my desk and all my filing cabinets and expected I wouldn't come back. But I did. And I sat there for 2 weeks. Couldn't get my phone out because he turned my phone off. You know, he said I couldn't take anything with me, and I didn't. Now, I'm sure he took a conniption. I'm getting to the point in a sec. When he opened the filing cabinet the Monday after, I wasn't there and found out that the files were all there. However, I had shredded them all. Every single last file. So I stayed within them. Now, I'll tell you why I did this. This is a man who, for the entire year and a quarter I worked for him, because he took over as a managing director, you may have to beep this out, but this man told me every single day, I think he had a list of terms that started with loser and asshole and sort of went to every single day he told me what a moron I was and I would never amount to anything in my life, and how lucky I was that I was working with him. So, you know, whatever. But I did find out the year after I left that collectively, the 5 people I left behind collectively billed $116,000. So the $758,000 that I billed, I'm getting to the point, I kept 52. So I went out on my own. And within 3 months, I've made nothing. But my boss decides to take my Rolodex of contacts and send them all a letter that says, David's left, I've taken over his accounts. If you do business with him, not only will I sue him, I will sue you.
Well. Oh my goodness.
So, have you ever been down to Canary Wharf?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm the Canadian guy that hired the guys that built the retail section of Canary Wharf. And I got that deal because my former boss sent a letter to the guys that were building Canary Wharf. And they phoned me up and said, if you've scared your former employer so much, you got to be pretty good. And I said, well, I think I am. And we took it from there. So, you know, in 1988, you're asked the question, you know, is it worth $100 million? No. At that time, I started charging $75 an hour. I was so desperate. And it wasn't until I raised my fee to $150 an hour, the same thing they were giving consulting engineers, did anybody take me seriously. So what's this got to do with $100 million? I've done whatever I needed to do to get into a marketplace. You know, I wrote Guerrilla Marketing for Job Hunters because I read Guerrilla Marketing. My budget for my first year in marketing was $21. I spent $17 on this book, Guerrilla Marketing, and it taught me how to do marketing for little or no money. I mean, that's what caught me. It was Guerrilla Marketing, 101 ways to market yourself without spending a dime. So I'm in. I spent my $20, not a dime, and, you know, I started marketing. So that's how I got what I got. And the reason I've kept my rates at 33% is because once you go down, you never go back up.
Right.
But I do deals with clients all the time, you know, but I get something out of it. So if I'm going to charge you 33%, I'm going to get something out of it. But $100 million? No, it's probably closer to 45.
Okay.
Maybe 50. The last couple of years, last 10 years, it's always been 33%. But I remember we hired actually 64 people in a company that had 68 people. Didn't hire the CEO, didn't hire the CFO, didn't hire either of their secretaries, but everybody else we hired because we replaced everyone in the company.
Wow.
And I think the total fee for that was over 3 years was probably about $400,000. So if you looked at all the salaries and you added them all up, you'd go, that's crazy, man. You left, you know, $2 million on the table. But did I? Seriously, did I? No, I didn't. Because every single one of those came with my ability to spin a story afterwards. And I was in the press on a regular basis and portrayed as a white knight, Robin Hood, good guy, because that's the persona I wanted. So when I trade cash, it's for something. And it's usually looking at the next deal. And I tell my kids, and I have four children, four adult children, three girls, one boy. Like pool. Anybody can shoot and sink one ball, but setting up the next four and sinking them, whole different level of skill. And my kids know this. And I remember taking my son out last year for a pool game. And you stop me, Mark, if I'm way off topic for your group. But we had never played pool. And we played the first round and, you know, and he started laughing at me because, you know, I wasn't really any good. But neither were the people I was playing with, right? There was a point to it. And finally, his kidding just annoyed me so much that I just said, okay. And I just sunk the next five shots. And he goes, oh, yeah, I get it now. I said, do you really? Do you? Do you really? Yeah, that's the point. So anyway, off topic.
Wow.
You get to cut that anyway.
You have so many stories. And there's a few things I want to pick up on there. But look, 40 or 50 million in lifetime cash in. I think I would take that. I'd be perfectly happy with that, David. So
when you have four kids, it gets eaten quickly.
Well, I've got three, so I know about that.
Yeah. Stop.
Oh, believe me, that's it. That's it. So you mentioned guerrilla marketing, and that's another thing we have in common because the author of the guerrilla marketing book. Jay Conrad Levinson. He wrote a whole. In fact, he coined the term guerrilla marketing, and he wrote a whole series, which of course you co-authored one of those as well. I became the UK's first certified guerrilla marketing coach, and that was a program that was run. This is going back about 20 years with Mitch Meyerson and Mitch Meyerson and Jay. Mitch did most of it, but I did have the good pleasure and honor of speaking to Jay as part of that program before he passed away a few years ago here. Just a brilliant, brilliant guy.
Oh, so, he's a great guy.
Yeah, you must have gotten to know him quite well. How did you end up writing a book together?
I live in Quebec.
Yeah.
You know the politics of the country. I am a Federalist. So that means I root for the good guys, because in Quebec there's two parties. There's the Federalists, who believe in a united Canada, yeah, and the Separatists, who want to take Quebec out of Canada. So I'm the one that wants to keep them in Canada. And I've been vocal. I still live in Quebec. I was born in Quebec City, lived in Montreal, and now live in the Quebec side of Ottawa. I'm a rabid Federalist. So there came a point in time where I helped organize a couple rallies, or at least one big rally, to bring people to Montreal when they're doing the last referendum for the yes vote or the no vote. And, you know, we swarmed the city with probably 100,000 people, a lot of buses we organized on Parliament Hill. So as part of this, my kids have always gone to the English school system in Quebec, which means like poor. Poor is like dirt. I mean, this school board has been broken, busted, and broke for decades. And I remember walking on to the playground of my first daughter's junior school, grade one to six. And the only piece of playground equipment they had was a culvert. Now, these are these big cement things you put in the ground to run sewage through. That and a pole that had three basket things on it for basketball. That's the only playground equipment we had on the school. And the school had been around for 48 years. So I became the chair and learned a lot more about the school system. So as part of this, I decided that I was going to help build or fund English-speaking schools in Quebec. So I started the Western Quebec, Western Quebec Education Alliance, something like that. I needed to raise money, so I ended up writing a book. I ended up writing a book because along came the referendum, the good guys won, so we got to keep Quebec and Canada, yay! But Quebecers still didn't fund the English education. So I wrote a book around the same time that the tech industry is falling into the toilet, because when Nortel laid off like 8,000 people on a Friday afternoon, I'm in New York City, don't know anything about this. No one sent me a memo. No one asked permission. They just posted here's the top 10 list of recruiters from J.P. Morgan did this. You know, they got, I think, $4 million to do the outplacement, and their outplacement was, take them in the cafeteria and say, "You're not here tomorrow," right? Here's a list of people to go and talk to. We were on the top of the list. So I come back Monday and I'm walking to my office, and we're in an old part of Ottawa in a Victorian home. And I've walked past, it turns out to be like 800 plus people. And I'm thinking, I think they're going to the British Embassy to get their passport stamped. I don't know, right? They're all in suits, got briefcases. Nope. Follow them right to my door in the Victorian house. And I said, "Who are these people, the Christine and Nikki?" And they said, "This is what happened. They told me about the list that got published, and we're on the top of the list." So these were all job hunters. Like, oh my God.
So wait. Let me just get this straight. So Nortel was laying people off. They published a list of recruiters to go and talk to. Your firm was at the top of the list. So you walked into the office in the morning, and there was a lineup of 800 people waiting to talk to you.
837. Nikki went out and counted them.
Holy
837. Cow. She went out and counted them. I sent her on a mission. So we got five phone lines. Can't get a phone line out because everybody's calling in. They didn't walk in. So I decided to go down to Chapters, our local bookstore, and make a list of, here's the books you should read. Because back in 80, we actually had a website, you know, modest, but we could post a list and refer people to that. So I'm sitting in the bookstore and I read about 10 or 11 books, and they're all so old. So I decided to go home and write my own version, like a small little, you know, how-to, right? Well, the how-to ended up at like 1,100 pages. And I hired my dad as an editor, and he helped me edit it down to about 110 pages. So I liked it. I owed him two boxes of red pen, fucker. And so he said, I don't believe it was that many. But anyway, he got two boxes of red pens, former school teacher and naval officer. Anyway, I phoned Jay and said, "Listen, Jay, my name is, and I wrote a book about, you know, and I've read everything you've ever written. Ask me any question." I said, "I've just written a book. Would you mind taking a read of it? See what you think." He said, "Sure." So I emailed it to him. Big file back then. And he calls me back about 3 days later, and he said, "I like this. I gave it to my daughter because she's looking for a job. And she likes it. It's helping." He said, "Anything else I can do?" I said, "Well, would you write the foreword?" He goes, "Sure. But I'm an author." He said, "So I get paid for writing." I said, "Well, how much?" He said, $1,000. I said, "Done. Check's in the mail." So he wrote the foreword for the first book. And when I gave him his copy, I flew up to Toronto, to have lunch with him because he was given a seminar, I think it was for Honda. And I met him, and I'm driving him back to the airport, and I jokingly said, so you got to be careful what you say. I jokingly said, you know, we should write guerrilla marketing for job hunters. He thought that was a good idea. So good that he called his agent, who's my agent now, in California and says, hey, we're going to do guerrilla marketing for job hunters. And I got just the guy to do it. So he calls me up, my not knowing this. And Michael asked me if I'd be interested. I said, sure. So I figure I'm going to be a co-author with J. Conrad Levinson, my hero. Oh, my God. I'm ecstatic. Wait for it. So about 3 months go by and Michael calls me and he says, so how's the book coming? I said, I don't know. He said, what do you mean you don't know? I said, Jay won't take my calls. He said, what are you talking about? I said, well, I got to get together with him. I got to build out, you know, the book. And he said, no, David. Jay's the brand. You're the writer. And I went, what? He said, yeah. He said, and the first, you know, and it's overdue, right? So I sat down literally for 6 weeks and cranked out a chapter every 4 days for Guerrilla Marketing for Job Hunters, the first initial edition. And sent it in, sent it to a couple of my friends who I met on RecNet, and they, you know, bashed it, and I would correct things. And I sent it in, and Wiley called me back. John Wiley and Sons did the book and said, we love it, but it's, we want 65,000 words, and yours is 119,000. So we're going to cut it up, and, you know, we'll send you it when we're finished editing. I said, no. I will edit it. Well, we need it Monday. I said, that's fine. I will edit it. So I took my manuscript from 119,000 words down to 91,000, sent it in. I told them it was 91,000. And 3 weeks later, they called me back and said, okay, we've been through it. There's nothing we can take out. So we're going to publish it, but it's going to be more expensive than $14.95. We're going to have to charge $19.95 to account for all the extra trees we've got to plant and that kind of stuff. So that's how we began. And Jay, so I did all the writing. Jay wrote his intro, or his, you know, thank you for, you know, thank you, madam, members of the Academy for this award sort of thing, which is fine. He is the brand, but that was a massive lesson, right? And, but he started to market it, and Wiley had only ever had one hit in the career section. So they were completely out of it. The guy that bought this book from us, the editor that bought it from us, the day I handed in the manuscript, he retired. So I had no editor, nothing. I had to defend myself with the publisher and all everyone around the review board all by myself. Anyway, they published it, and they did a short run. They did 1,000 copies because that's most books sell 211 copies, and the rest get remandered. So they didn't want to waste the money. Well, they didn't tell me that. And I didn't know that, and Jay didn't tell me that. So I'm marketing like crazy, right? Well, you know, it's on Amazon. It sells 4,000 copies the first week. And I got Wiley.
That's amazing.
I got Wiley on the phone call. I got Wiley on the phone yelling at me because I sold so many copies of the book. And I said, I don't understand. What's the problem? And that's when they told me that they weren't expecting the book to sell. So they only printed 1,000 copies, and they couldn't get it back on the press for like 6 or 8 weeks. Well, you know what? Well, here's the problem. I put my name and phone number in the book. Don't ever do that. Don't ever do that. So I'm fielding calls from all over the place from people who are angry because they can't get a copy. This is well before Kindle, right? So, you know, I called Jay up and I said, what do I do? He says, well, thank God. He's Jewish. I'm Catholic. He says, thank God that, that's a problem. He says, just don't answer the phone if they call, or tell them it's coming, or get in line, or put in an order. So that's what we did. And the next print run sold out again. So, you know, it was my writing and Jay's, you know, magic with the marketing that produced a book that's been quite well used.
That's amazing. And that's a good problem to have to over, you know, be oversubscribed, right? To have more sales than you can ship. I would rather have that than sell 211 books and the rest get destroyed.
Absolutely. I would have been devastated. My feelings would have been hurt. Both of them.
So a couple of things that I want to circle back to. One, this situation where you had 800 people that prompted you to, or inspired you to write the book, because you looked out there and you couldn't really find anything current that you think would help people. When was that, David?
That was 2003.
Okay.
So that's a part I've forgotten. Sorry, I'm old. So I wrote the book so that I could sell it, not guerrilla marketing. I wrote The Headhunter's Guide to the New Economy. My dad made me change it because he was worried I was going to get sued by my favorite author who wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe. Remember?
Oh, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. My son is reading that right now.
I love that book. So I wrote Headhunter's Guide to the New Economy. He said, change it, you're going to get sued. So it was called Career Guide. It used to be
You've written
shelf.
So many books, you can't remember them.
I can't. It was the first one. Anyway, so I wrote that and I published it, but electronically. So we were selling it for $40 US online as a download, just a texting download. And we were using that money to put into the education foundation that I had started to raise money to teach English kids in school, right?
Oh, cool.
And that raised a lot of money. We were paying $750 a month. This is how old the internet is. $750 a month to get the another service to clear the Visa MasterCard because we couldn't get a license to do that.
Right.
Way back in this predates PayPal.
Of course.
So that's where that's why I did it. It just killed two birds with one stone, right? I mean, I had no idea. It was supposed to be a good PR stunt. Not even a stunt. It was just the right thing to do. I had no idea it was going to take off like this. You know, and when I jokingly said to Jay, you know, we should write guerrilla marketing for job hunters. Mark, I swear to God, I was kidding. And then the next thing you know, you're in the middle of this thing, right? And it's why not?
That's awesome. I like that story. But what happened with these 800 people? I need to hear the conclusion of that. So they're lined up outside. And then what'd you do?
And I closed my door. I stood outside and I said, the first husband and wife team, because it was a husband and wife team who got there first, something like 5 a.m. in the morning. And this is a Victorian house and I've got like a 300 square foot mini office inside this thing. So I took them in, I listened to their story, and I liked them, and I did the wrong thing. I found them both jobs, but I told them, don't. So I'll get in ahead. So I went out in the crowd and said, I'm going to interview two people. So I got all I got time for. Everybody else went home, and they never came back, which was interesting, right? Persistence, engineers, not so much. Anyway, I placed both of these people into new jobs. And when I did it, I specifically said, don't tell anyone. You have no friends. I don't need the PR. Well, they did. Because they, unbeknownst to me, they had a friend who was a job search coach who let it be known that he knew the headhunter in his private network. He knew the headhunter that had placed Bill and Joanne. And he could introduce them. So, well...
I don't understand, David. Why did you not want any referrals from that or any recognition?
I don't find jobs for people. Now, having said that, I've done that. I market. I get hired by companies to fill specific roles. Every now and then, one in 100,000 is a real rising star. And that rising star, you can ask them, what do you want to do? Where do you want to work? You can go and create that. You can make that opening happen at the executive level, right? And that's what we do. We still do that. But, 95% of our business is we have a need. We need to solve a problem. You're going to hire the people that are going to solve the problem. So I didn't want to be inundated. I'm not a job search coach, by the way.
Got it.
I'm not because I don't have much pity for people. If I tell you what to do and you don't do it, I don't care what the psychology behind it is. You didn't do it. So it's no longer my problem. It's your problem. And we're never talking again. That's why I wrote, I don't know if you got a chance to go on to the new platform, mynewjobhunt.com.
No, mynewjobhunt.com. What is that about?
So mynewjobhunt.com is a platform for job hunters that helps them much more quickly get a job than doing it the old fashioned way.
Okay.
Whatever the old fashioned way was. What we did after I launched the second edition of Guerrilla Marketing for Job Hunters is I started a Guerrilla Job Search Boot Camp. The first boot camp was $49. I launched this in November of 2000, and 9 in Detroit on stage. And I usually come out before I speak and do about, you know, 10, 15 minutes of stand-up. I can make people laugh, right? And if you make people laugh, you know, you engage them, right? And it's a better audience. So I did that. I walk out on the stage on the MSU auditorium in Minneapolis. And that was Detroit. It was, where was it? Starts with a T. It's a suburb of Detroit. Anyway, okay. I go out and I do this and no one laughs. No one even smiled. Uh-oh. And I'm looking out at the audience and I'm looking through like the people are just dead in the eyes. And they had to pay to get into this presentation. It was $29. Okay. We found out later, $29 is a lot of money for a lot of them. A lot of them, their kids put up the $29. In a couple of cases, their kids drove the parents to the presentation and then they waited in the parking lot to make sure they actually went in.
Wow.
Okay. I mean, this is Detroit. Unemployment at the time was 38.5%.
Right.
My editor told me, don't go to Detroit to launch the book. Unemployment's horrible. And I said, well, like, that's the point, right?
Right.
He said, well, if it fails, it fails. I said, well, if it fails, then we shouldn't be selling the book. Anyway, I digress. So we go, I go to give the presentation. I'm doing some stand-up. They're not laughing. I go backstage and Kevin says, so how are they? So they're all warmed up, ready to go. So we go out and 45 minutes into this presentation, people start to laugh and you can see the lights starting to flicker. So an hour into this presentation, we give them a bio break. And at the bio break, I said, listen, before you all leave, you know, to go out and get your snacks or whatever, because the doors are locked and you can't get out. I said, I'm kidding. They're not locked. You know that. I said, I'm going to take 7 people from the audience. 7 people. I want you to give me $49. And I'm going to put you through a job search boot camp and guarantee you a job. I will work with you until you get a job. $49. Well, we had trouble getting 7 people, but we did. We didn't have any trouble placing them. So, you know, Kevin says to me afterwards, he says, I'm co-presenting with Kevin Donlan at the time. I'm on the stage with a co-presenter because I'm about 5 months after my stroke. And my stroke had left me without the ability to walk, talk, read, or write. So it's the first time I'm presenting publicly, and I wasn't sure I could stand on stage and present by myself. So Kevin came with me. Best thing I ever did. We had a blast. So we got these 7 people, and Kevin says afterwards, you know, like, what job search boot camp? I said, well, this is Wednesday. By Monday, I'll have a job search boot camp. And I went home and I crammed, man, and I created a process. I took everything I know and put it on paper with if then, if then, if then, and created this process. So we've run guerrilla job search boot camps across the US and Canada for the last 12 years.
Wow.
That's and cool. And we have been charging upwards of $4,999. The difference is, you come and do a boot camp with us. Most of it's done online, virtual. We guarantee you a job, period, full stop. And we'll work with you until it's done. Now, we put 214 people through those boot camps. 212 graduated into new jobs. 2 of them we had to work with beyond the 10 weeks as a 10-week program, but they graduated as well. But it got really tiring, and I wanted to continue, but I didn't want to do this anymore. I mean, the money's fine, right? I mean, you do the math, right? But it's tiring, and it's not what I do. I'm a headhunter, and I love that. So we took the entire platform and put it online and put it in the cloud. And my partner that I was working with at the time was another Kevin, my best friend. He passed away on Canada Day 6 years ago.
Oh, gosh.
About 5 hours after, he told me he found the flaw in the product and we could now release it. And I said to him, what was it? He says, I'll tell you Monday. And then he went away and he died. And he took all the passwords and everything with him. And his brother, Dave Watson, his name was Kevin Watson, and I tried for 2 years to figure out, you know, what the passwords were to get into this thing. We couldn't.
Oh.
And after 2 years, we finally decided that's enough. So we took the last 2.5 years. Dave took a year and a half off. He was a senior engineer at Cisco. Took the last 2.5 years to take all of the ideas, the content that we had, and to build a platform that is both a CRM, mm-hmm. so contact relationship management program, to sum it up, my new job hunt is, if you're a recruiter, it's salesforce.com, but for job hunters. If you're a job hunter, it's more like eHarmony. So we'll take you through, well, seriously, we'll take you through a series of questions that we ask you at the front end. You push a button when you join, and it tells you whether or not you have, what your likelihood of graduating is, because we've done this so many times. And then once you're in the program, this is a set it to forget it program. The first week we teach you how to figure out what you want to do, who you want to do it for, what the messaging has to be for the people you want to contact. We show you how to write a resume, how to do the cover letter, so that, and it's a one pager, it's a guerrilla resume. So it's a one pager that gets read and gets people's attention. And then we show you how to write email messages that you're going to follow up, and voicemail messages that you're going to leave. So at the end of the first week, you have everything that you need physically to go out and get a job. And then we spend the next week teaching you all the social stuff, how to set up your LinkedIn profile. Because it's easier to take a call than to make a call, right? It's always been that way. So at the end of the second week, you do your first activity, and that is to it's called the email chain letter. No one likes chain letters. And we've actually written it. You just fill in a couple details. And the chain letter goes out. And the premise is pretty simple. You decide what 10 companies you want to work for. You say that in the letter. You tell them why your accomplishments fit that company. You say that in the letter. It's not hard, in the email. And then you send it off to 10 people that you know and respect. And you ask them to read it. And if they know anyone that works for those companies now or in the past, because we teach people how to recruit with the newly departed, not dead people, newly departed, to call. And if you don't, that's fine. Could you please pass it on to 10 and only 10 people that you know? Well, It's math, right? 10 to the power of 10 to the power of 10 to the power of 10. And so we know this works. And the email chain letter is actually responsible in our boot camps and since and currently for setting up more first-time interviews than anything we've ever done. Not the Starbucks coffee cup caper, nothing. Not the targeted Facebook ad campaigns, nothing. This email chain letter. So you do that on Friday, and most people who do this laugh until they start getting responses. You can Google it, email chain letter, guerrilla email chain letter. So my new job hunt is set up to be a set it and forget it, soups to nuts program that tracks everything in the background and reminds you of what tasks you have to do today to get to the point about 2 weeks out that you can actually start interviewing with the top 10 companies that you want to work for, and you understand why you want to work for them, who can hire you, and what you have to say to that person to get them to have coffee with you, to start a discussion. So that's what my new job hunt is. And, you know, I've been working on that hard now for the last 5 years. So most of the money that we've made over the last 5 years has gone into that. And about 60% of my time has gone into that. So my billings are way down. If I do $500,000 this year, I will. But that's where our efforts has gone. Why am I telling you this? Because the job search stuff, the headhunting stuff, has allowed me to do what I want to do, which is payback for the life I've had for the last 40 years. As a recruiter, you know how great the lifestyle is. You know how big a change you have in people's lives. And you can see that spark in their face. I don't know about you, but I have that glow that lasts for weeks. And you can't buy that, right? You can't buy that. And as I said to my kids, and you're going to have to cut this part out, I've taught my kids from the beginning that, there's only two people in life. You can either work for an asshole or be an asshole. Choose early. You know which one I chose. Does that answer your question, Mark?
Absolutely. So by the way, guys, for everyone listening, David, one thing I admire and respect about you is you're very creative and prolific. You get ideas, you action them, and you work fast, like the deadlines that you've hit for, the publishing of the books and so on. So that's amazing. And I love how you've created this whole other revenue stream, which also is allowing you to help thousands more people than you could possibly place, through your headhunting firm. By the way, anyone listening who is interested in how to generate an extra income stream with career coaching, I've done a webinar about that. I'll put the link in the show notes so you can check that out. You threw a couple of things in there that I want to follow up on. One was the stroke. When did that happen, David?
That was Easter Friday, 2008.
2009.
See, it's so long ago, and it's so funny. Well, it's not funny that I had a stroke. Well, actually, for me, it's funny I had a stroke, because for the first 4 days, it's like it's over Easter weekend, right? So I'm at this hospital. Everybody's on holiday. So there were five neurosurgeons, and I saw a different neurosurgeon every day. And I stopped being able to talk probably half an hour into arriving at the hospital. They weren't able to give me the shot quite in time, obviously, because I can talk. But I remember the first day that I was awake, and this young doctor, and we're now friends, this young doctor, you know, stands in intensive care, and my wife is standing there, and he's really good looking, like Marcus Welby good looking. And he puts his arm, and my wife is hot, and he puts his arm around her, and he pulls her in, and he says, brace yourself. He may stay in that vegetated state for the rest of his life. Yeah, well,
my goodness.
I can hear all this, right? The IO is fine. The processor is fine. The IO doesn't work, right? So for the next, and you're probably going to have to bleep this out as well, but this is a true story. And this is going to go in Guerrilla Marketing for Job Hunters 4.0. Talk about motivation. So for the first 4 days, I only wanted to say one thing. And I finally said it on the morning of the fifth day, because the guy that I was, like, I'm on the geriatrics ward by this time, and I'm on the ward in the hospital where they put all the old people who they want to make comfortable because there's nothing they can do for them. And this guy next to me in my room says, David, shut up. I said, what? He said, shut up. You're screaming. I said, and you can hear me and I'm talking and you can understand me, because I could talk in my head, but it wasn't coming out. Right. He says, yes. And I said, well, what am I screaming? He said, well, you've been screaming, fuck you, for the last 15 minutes. And I'm laughing, because for 4 days, I just wanted to tell that doctor, fuck you. And in fact, you know, my wife didn't know that I was still in here until the middle of the fourth day. She came in and I had taken, sounds so pathetic, right? I had taken this styrofoam cup I had with water in it, and I had taken my straw and carved a heart and put my initials and her initials in the cup. I could not talk to her, and I couldn't write, couldn't hold a pen. But I could do, it took me a long time to do this. And she looks at me and she says, you're in there. I said, yes, I am. So it's the next day, this is the funny part. The next day, when after he told me that to shut up, the doctor walks in, fifth neurosurgeon, right? It's Easter Sunday, and or Easter Monday. And she walks in and she says, which one of you are Mr. Perry? And I said, that would be me. And she looks at my chart. She goes, no, that's not you. I said, no, it's me. She said, no, well, I've been told Mr. Perry can't talk, you know? And I said, well, it's me. I mean, ask him his name. And I don't remember his name. He goes, oh, I'm so, anyway. So we lied. She said, well, you can talk. I said, clearly. So my wife doesn't know this, right? So she walks in and we met in the Army. Wonderful woman, 40 years now. We met in the Army. She walks in the morning and she's trying to keep a brave face, right? But it's not looking good. And everything she's been told is not good. So she walks in and she's got that look on her face. And I looked at her and I said, would you go home and get my briefcase and bring it back? She said, you can talk. I said, clearly. And we have a lot of work to do. And we did. Because unbeknownst to us in the background, a couple of our competitors here in Ottawa had found out that I'd had a stroke. And my client list is quite well known because, you know, people brag, or they used to brag. And so they ran around to all my clients and told them all that I was brain dead.
Oh, my goodness. You're joking.
You can't make this shit up. Technically, they were right. They were right, but not for long. So I found this out the hard way. And all of a sudden, all of my clients are calling and we can't answer the phone because I can't answer the phone. I can't talk to them. So I get out 10 days later and I start calling my clients back and I tell them the story. And so they all love me or love us. And so they delayed searches or they canceled the search and so that I wouldn't be under stress. Well, you're self-employed. You're under stress to close a month. And I got lucky because when that happened, the Wall Street Journal article came out. They had done an article. They'd done an interview with me in October of 2008. And the young journalist that did it, Sarah Needleman, brought, as the story goes, if I remember correctly, brought it to her editor, who didn't believe that the story was true, but some of the stunts I pulled, you know. So he wanted her to dig up some dirt on me, because at that time, there was a bunch of recruiters come coaches that were scamming people. I mean, that was the days of, Drake Bean Morey, but there was an outfit. 20 years, well, I guess they've been gone now for about 10 years, but they got sued for $35 billion. So they're gone.
Oh my goodness.
And if I could remember their name, but it's a senior's moment, you'd shake your head, going, oh yeah, I remember those guys. So, where was I? Hold on. I was talking about, he sent her to do find some dirt on me so they could do another piece that would be a more sensational piece. Couldn't find anything. They interviewed, I gave them 10 people to interview, and they did something like 90 plus. And then they finally released the article. And that's where it was, on the front page of the business section of the Wall Street Journal. And that's where I got the nickname, the Rogue Recruiter, because that's what they nicknamed me.
I like it.
Oh, I loved it. I mean, they were so worried that I was going to be offended. And they called me up and said, I can't let you read the article because it's going to come out. It's going to be on the front page. It got bumped to the front page of the business section, such is life. But I can tell you that we've nicknamed you the Rogue Recruiter, and I just want you to know that. Are you going to be offended? And I said, no, I think that's great. So the article came out just as I'm tanking, because all my clients have stopped their business. And we just went into retrograde. It just took off. And the reason...
What do you mean? Like, what was the response when that article came out?
Well, you know, I wrote Hiring Greatness. I don't know if you've read that book.
I haven't yet. I've got it on order.
So that book is my 1,000th search. The gentleman, so it's a true story. And the gentleman that's in Fred, the gentleman that's in Hiring Greatness as the hiring manager, called me up because he'd read the article. He said, hi, my name is Fred. You know, I can't pronounce his last name. And he said, are you the Rogue Recruiter? And I said, yeah. And so we had this conversation. He said, listen, I've hired the, I won't tell you who they are, but it's the top two search firms in the world. Hired them both over the last 2 years to hire me a COO, and both of them taken all my money, $125,000 each, and none of them have produced anything. I said, are you any good? I said, yeah. I said, I'd like to hire you. And I said, well, you know, if you want to hire me, and I'm thinking, oh God, because I know it's my 1,000th search coming up, right? And this should be a good search. This should be one to write a blog article about. So I said, listen, I'll send you a contract. So I sent him a contract, and I sent him a demand for 2 first-class tickets to LA and a retainer. And I think the retainer was a third at the time, a third and two thirds. So I think it was $25,000.
Okay.
So he sends me the 2 tickets and a check for $25,000. So I said, okay. So we fly down to meet Fred Tyshynski, great man. And he starts to tell me his story, and I won't blow it because you need to read the first 4 pages of Hiring Greatness, and then you'll read the rest of it.
Okay.
But, no, I'll tell you. So what happened was, so I go to ask him some questions, right? I go to ask him some questions. We've done the pleasantries. And I said, can I ask you some questions? And he goes, no. He said, you work for me now. And I said, oh, really? And I reach into my vest pocket. This is all in the book. I reach into my vest pocket. I pull out the envelope. I hold out a check. I said, do you recognize this? He goes, yeah, it's my check. I said, great. So I haven't cashed it yet. I said, I flew down here to ask you 3 questions. I'm going to ask you the 3 questions. If you answer the 3 questions correctly, I'm going to cash your check. We're going to do the search. We're going to find your COO. Answer one of them wrong, and I tear through the signature block, and we go for lunch. And I didn't ask him if that was okay. I just asked the first question. Anyway, it goes on from, and that's the opening of the book.
I love it.
That was my 1,000th. Search. So okay. I wrote a book based on that 1,000 search, what we did, how we did it, why we did it. So that's the search. And then Executive Recruiting for Dummies is the actual functional. Here's what you have to do as a dummy. If you can't follow it in Hiring Greatness, that's what you actually have to do to get there. I don't remember what the original question was you asked me, but that was my answer.
Fantastic. Okay. So I need to go back to the stroke, because I feel like...
Stroke, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine what that would feel like if you can't... like, you're thinking, but you can't actually see it. It must have been sort of claustrophobic.
Oh, it was, honest to God, scariest Second scariest moment of my life. My scariest was handing my daughter over to heart surgeons when she was 3 months old and not knowing what the result was going to be. She's 21, by the way.
Wow.
So we know what the result was. But that was the second scariest. Third scariest was, you know, proposing to my wife, who's my business partner, Anita Martell.
Right. Yeah. That's a whole nother story.
The stroke was, again, I got lucky. I'm sitting at home. And when I say I was learning to talk, I could speak words, but I couldn't put concepts together. Like the term can and not were two different words. And it's not like I understood cannot when I spoke. And I had Tourette's for about, that was funny. God, it was funny. For me, because I got over it. For about 6 months. Yeah, I said the most inappropriate stuff at the most inappropriate moment. And I won't tell you any of it. Inappropriate moments. It was terrifying. And when I started to be well, which really took probably 2 months, maybe three. You have to ask my wife. I was up for a good 45 minutes to an hour. And I'll say conscious, because I was awake longer than that. But thinking wise and ability to speak, probably 45 minutes to an hour. So that's when I did my calls with clients.
Wow.
That's when I did my recruiting. So we told no one. You know, at the end of the day, we ended up telling, I told the clients that canceled the searches because they needed to know. They knew me well enough not to say anything. We denied it to everybody else. I didn't tell candidates. I didn't tell new clients. And I just focused, but like a laser, on who I needed to talk to, what I needed to say, why they needed to hear it. And that was it. And that's still what I do today.
So let me get this straight, David. So this is every day that you were working for the first few months while you were recovering. The first sort of hour you were, you couldn't, you know, like you had to get warmed up and get up to speed. And then.
So good question to ask. About quarter to 10.
Okay.
To quarter to 11 every day.
Yeah.
I was 100%.
Okay. Wow. So you had to be focused like a laser for that hour.
Yep. Beyond that, I was sleeping or resting. You know, the doctors all told me to take 2 years off. And I remember laughing. The doctor said, no, I'll write you a note. Get you a year off of work. And I said, that's not going to work. He said, why? He says, because, you know, I got a partner. So, that's fine. I said, listen, my partner's my wife. She's not going to take any excuses. I said, she didn't care. She didn't.
I thought you were going to say, because my boss is a real asshole, he won't accept this note.
Yeah, I didn't want to be self-deprecating.
So, wow. And how long did that continue for, David?
When did I make a full recovery?
Yeah.
Or when was it back up to?
Well, yeah, your recovery, how long did that take and what did that involve? Because had you not told me that story, I would have no idea that you'd suffered a stroke.
So the first, I was 100% billable and working probably in about a year.
A year, yeah.
I self-diagnosed and went to my doctors and I told them I had sleep apnea. And he said, no, you don't. And I said, yes, I do. And I said, and I'm suicidal, by the way. Wow. So we need to do something about both of those. So I got medicated. It took me two more visits where I had to literally threaten the doctor that I've told my wife this, I've written it down. So now it's your problem. So if I do something stupid, I said, you're going to lose your license. So
yes,
we did all the studies. I got medicated. And then I went and did a sleep study. And lo and behold, I had sleep apnea. I was waking up every 59 seconds.
Oh.
I had severe sleep apnea. So they gave me this mask. Oh my God. The first day I used it, I was up like 12 hours and totally lucid. It was fantastic. So now I've got a CPAP and I plug that in and juice up every single night. I don't really need it as much, but I do it anyway. It's like, wow. And to get back in the game and to learn language, I did a couple things happened again by accident. One day I was watching Oprah. Swear to God, I've never watched Oprah before in my life. Swear to God. Swear to God. But I'm watching Oprah that day, and she interviews an author who had a stroke. And she was a neurosurgeon. But they didn't find her for like 12 or 13 hours. So she lost everything. And to the point where she was locked away, and they tried to teach her to, you know, to hold a fork. No, it was, but she wrote a book because her mother, after 7 or 8 years, walked in the hospital, picked her up, took her home, and did the therapy herself. And so she's fine now. She's a great writer. She's a good preach speaker. And what she learned then that she put in the book, and this is now a known fact, it's called My Stroke of Insight. That's the book, My Stroke of Insight. And I have handed that book out to probably 30 people over the last 4 or 5 years, people that have either had a stroke or they have a loved one that's had a stroke. I go out, get a copy of the book, tell them my story and say, read the book, you'll understand. So I'm reading that book and I get the fact that my brain's a muscle. And everybody else said, go to sleep and rest. No, I had to try to use it more and more and more. Right. So the hardest part of the first couple of years were the massive headaches I would get when I was trying to think or write. And learning to read and write again was a challenge, and speak as well. So what I did, and my editor now knows this as the truth. What I did was one afternoon, I called my editor and said, hey, guerrilla marketing for job hunters is, it's 5 years old now. You know, we got it, or 4 years old, whatever it was. We got to do a second edition. And she said, really? Is there that much change? I said, oh my God. I said, I'll write a new book and it'll be 80% new content. She said, you know what? 20% new content's fine. I said, fine, 20% new content. I wrote 80% new content. as I'm hanging up the phone, my wife comes around the corner in the home office and she says, what are you doing? You can't really read. You can't write, because I couldn't use my hands yet. You can't read, you can't write, and you're really only awake an hour a day. I said, yeah, but I'm awake. So I've made this commitment. My editor said, can you have it to me in a year? This was June. I said, no, I'll give it to you in September. I got so many things on the go, but I just don't have time for this to waste. So she just shook her head and walked away. And she comes in the next day, and I've got this giant, I had at the time, giant whiteboard in my office at home. It's 4 feet by 8. Horizontal across the wall. She comes in, she says, what's that? I could not write. I could draw. Hmm. Weird. So she goes, oh my God, that's the book. I said, yeah, I had drawn out in pictures the entire book from start to finish on the whiteboard. And wow. Then what I had to do was figure out, how do I fill in that content? So guerrilla marketing for job hunters, the first one, I was lucky or smart. It was lucky. I wasn't smart. I reached out to a bunch of my friends in the recruiting business when I wrote Guerrilla Marketing for Job Hunters. And I said, listen, I've written this book and it's insanity. I said, you read this book, you think I'm crazy. However, I want you to read it because if you like it, I think you'll see it. I said to all my, I think you'll get what I'm getting at. If you like it, then I'm going to invite you to write like a 500 to 800 word piece for the book. So I did that to Rayanne Thorne, to Shallery Steckrell, to a whole bunch, you know, Glenn Gouchmer, a whole bunch of people that are still in the business today. And they all wrote a piece. So when I had the stroke and I'm doing the second book, I reach out to them again and said, hey, they don't know I had the stroke. I'm doing the second edition and I want you to write on this. And I invited a bunch of other people. So the second edition of the book has about 28 people in it who all wrote 500, 800 word pieces. And then I did a bunch of case studies. So at the end of the day, it is 80% new information. 15% of it's not mine. It comes from them. And they got full credit in the book. And I did that for the third edition and I'll do it for the fourth edition. And that's how I wrote the book. And from there, it was that second edition launching it in Detroit where we started the boot camp. So, you know, when you're faced with someone asked me this a couple of years ago, why do you do all this shit? Because I can. And why bother to think about, like, I'm so naive. My philosophy is, why bother to, if you call it a philosophy, why bother to think about what you can do when you can just go and do it? And at the end of the day, you know, we're well enough off. I've made enough money. I've got enough things that I don't have to worry about who gets credit. So it's amazing what you can accomplish when you don't care who gets the credit and you just want to solve the problem. So that's why all these books, you know, Hiring Greatness. Can you be a recruiter? Absolutely. Read the book. Executive Recruiting. Can you be a recruiter after this? Absolutely. But Mark, you and I both know how much work is involved. It's like, are you a Trekkie?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, good man. Okay, so I'll continue this. So there's a fine line between reading the manual, right, and driving the enterprise. Anybody can read, it's like recruiting. Anybody can read the manual. Actually doing it, a different story. So Hiring Greatness and Executive Recruiting for Dummies were not written to put recruiters out of business. Mm-hmm. They were written to make hiring managers more informed. More informed so that they know that when they hire us, we can do the job. And HR, who usually generally mostly can't do the job, can rest knowing that they wrote, that they read the book as well. And then if I don't do all these steps, they can crucify me and set me on fire in the parking lot and justify it because I said I was going to do this and I didn't do it. So the book wasn't written to put recruiters out of business. The books were written to put HR back where HR needs to be in personnel. Okay. Salaries, benefits, making sure people are happy and organizing the Christmas party. And I don't mean that in a negative way. And although I can't pull up his name off the top of my head right now, the impetus to do Hiring Greatness. So this is 8 years after I've written the last Guerrilla book. Was twofold. One, I had been at a dinner where the guy who wrote, that's whose name I'm blanking on, the guy who wrote Why We Hate HR, was speaking to about 300 people at dinner in Ottawa about the book and blah, blah, blah. And not really backpedaling, but kind of. But I'm sitting around this table where not many people in HR know who I am at that dinner. And they're all denying that they do that or that this guy's crazy or that there's any, and I'm thinking, oh my God, you guys just don't get it. So I went back and I said, okay, check mark. I got to write a book on this, so filed it away. And then one day I'm listening to Terry Matthews, who built Mitel and New Bridge and all these great companies. He's arguing with another friend of mine at an event, not arguing, discussing with Ed. And Ed's about 92. And the two of them are having this back and forth from the front of the room and the back of the room. There's about 200 tech people in the room. And I suddenly looked around and I realized that they didn't get it. I got it. Maybe three or four other people in the room got it. What are you talking about? But the rest of the room didn't. And I thought, oh my God, if I don't capture what I know, that would be a real crime. So I sat and because everyone's going to pass. What Terry talks about and how he goes about doing business, a lot of that's in the book. Not his principles, but not his ideas, but a lot of the principles. Mm-hmm. And so when I sat down to write the book, it was with Why We Hate HR and you know the fact that you know a lot of people weren't going to understand how to build a business correctly in tech when these two guys decided they didn't want to talk about this stuff anymore. So that was the impetus. So the guy that wrote Why We Hate HR, he got the first book and Terry got the second one.
That's interesting. Listen, you made a couple of throwaway comments earlier that I want to pick up on. What was the Starbucks coffee caper?
The Starbucks coffee cup caper is an interesting job search tactic. Okay. It actually didn't start off as Starbucks. It started off as Tim Hortons.
Of course.
I wasn't exactly Canadian, right? I wasn't actually the inventor of this. A guy by the name of Daryl Prail and Alan Zander are two guys that I had recruited and put in a company called CML. And they took the company from worst to first and into a almost 3x multiple exit. And their reward for doing that was to be axed by the company with no notice that had bought them. And so when they came back, I had destroyed their lives. I mean, they've been there for a year and a half or so, but I destroyed their lives. So I took them out of another place and put them somewhere. So Daryl turns to me one day and he says, so are you actually any good at this shit? And I'm writing guerrilla marketing for job hunters, right? He says, but are you actually any good at this shit? I said, yeah. And he said, prove it. And so I said, okay. So what I did is I took Daryl and Alan on as a team, a pair, and I marketed them. And so I did all the guerrilla recruiting stuff in the background, and they prepared the marketing stuff. I did the resumes, and I worked on them, but they did a bunch of stuff. And we had a 10-point plan. One of the points Daryl came up with, Del Perez, he's now the chief marketing officer for VanillaSoft. VanillaSoft.com, you can see his stuff. You should follow him. He's brilliant. Anyway, he came up with this idea that he was going to send a picture of himself in a coffee cup caper via FedEx saying, "You need me." The picture holding a sign saying, "You need me, here's why." Just to spark a conversation. And he sent it to 10 companies, and he got 8 callbacks, and he got 6 interviews. Anyway, and it goes on and on. And all these stats are actually in Guerrilla Marketing for Job Hunters 2.0.
Okay.
Because that opens the book, because Alan said, "Well, you know, how do we know you're going to be doing this stuff?" And I love Alan Zander. He's now the CEO. He's been there for more than 10 years of Data Kinetics. These are the guys that MasterCard and Visa and Home Depot use their technology to authorize 14,000 transactions a second. So wow. That's how okay. The technology is. Been around for ages. So I said, "Well, how do we know you're actually going to do this?" Fair question. So I phoned up Peter Clayton. So Peter Clayton runs TotalPicture.com. Okay. So what Peter did was he did three interviews with Daryl and Alan. He did an interview with them, a podcast interview with them, asking them, you know, why are we doing this? What's the situation? What are you guys doing? So they talked about what their situation was and how I was going to the market and how we were marketing this whole thing and what my part was. And then Peter followed them through the search. About midway, he phoned them up and interviewed both of them again, asking them questions about how it was going, what are you doing, all that kind of stuff. And then after they landed, the same thing. So Peter Clayton, who runs TotalPicture.com, did this and kept me in check. So does the ship really work? Absolutely. And, you know, it has always been feet to the fire all the time. Does that answer that question?
Yeah, it sort of does, but I still don't understand what were they physically sending with the coffee.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mark. So what you do is, so let's talk about the Starbucks coffee cup caper, because no one in the States knows who the heck Tim Martins is, right?
Sure.
So you walk into Starbucks, and most Starbucks employees now know this because it's been going on for 10 years, right? And you ask them for 10 empty cups. They'll give you 10 empty cups. You go home, you go to Staples, and you get 10 of those boxes that are mailers.
Okay, yeah.
You take your Guerrilla one-page resume with your one-page Guerrilla cover letter that says, you know, you got this problem. I know you got this problem, and I've done this, this, and this. We should sit down and have a coffee.
So
what you're doing is you stick that in a Starbucks coffee cup, a clean Starbucks coffee cup, a paper Starbucks coffee cup, not a used one, not a porcelain one. I've had all these questions before. You put it in the box, and you send it 2-day FedEx.
Yeah.
Because what happens is it's cheaper.
Yeah.
And you get a ping that tells you that your box has arrived at its destination, and you wait 45 minutes. And then you call the person and say, "Hey, Mark, David Perry, I think you just got my package." Yeah. You know, and they 45 minutes, they've got it. They've opened it. They're laughing. They're going, "What is this?" Because it's a Starbucks coffee cup. And there's a resume cover letter in it that's inviting you to have a coffee with them. And you're reading this letter, realizing, "Oh my God, this guy has solved all these problems that I have." And you've written this down because you've networked with the newly departed and found out these are the issues that these people have. And then written that letter and that cover and that resume just for them and sent it. And they laugh and go, "Oh my God, am I on candid camera?" "No, man, there's no cameras in that building that I know of. I didn't imagine. And I just want to have coffee and tell you how I solved that problem."
That's funny. It occurs to me, you could use the same approach for prospecting, right?
Yes, you can.
So there's one more thing I need to know, because you mentioned earlier, and I'm really curious. Facebook targeted ads, you also mentioned, and how does that fit into the equation?
I had this kid in 2006 or 2007, Grant. Right. I can't remember Grant's last name. Call me and say he'd read the book. And he's just graduating from Pepperdine University. And I said, "Great, congratulations." He says, "Well, you know, I want to try some of this stuff, but not sure how it's going to work." I said, "Well, it's worked for everybody else. What's your problem?" He said, "It's not a problem." He said, "But, you know, I have a very particular group that I want to target." And I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, I ran the Gay and Lesbian Association of Pepperdine University, and I want to work for a PR a gay-friendly PR firm in Seattle. I said, oh, okay. I said, what's the problem? He said, well, how do I do that? I said, oh, that's easy. I said, so it was me. I would do the research, find out the firms, and then I would set up a targeted email. I would set up a targeted Facebook campaign so that when they come online, your message only appears to those 10 or 15 people that you choose want to get that message and would be open to having a call with you because for some reason you've done the research and found out that they are LGBTQ. And he said, will that work? I said, try it and find out. Now, he did it and he was very successful. And then he wrote about it. He actually blogged about it. And that was the first time that had been done. I can go back and find it. I still have the, I interviewed him a couple years later on video. But he did this. He got the interviews. He got the offers. He didn't take anything. He took something in LA instead. But this is where this Facebook, targeted Facebook advertising concept came from. So when you roll in networking with the newly departed, you do a one-page resume that probably got your picture on it, got logos in it, got quotes about how great you are, so you don't tell people how great you are, you let somebody else tell them how great you are, you know, second party, third party endorsement. So when you combine that with the email chain letter and the targeted Facebook advertising campaign, because that's what I did with my daughter, you get interviews, you get meetings. And out of those meetings, if you've got enough juice and ask the right questions, they're going to want to hire you, either for a contract to try you out or permanently to take you off the street before somebody else does. So that's what that Facebook targeted Facebook advertising campaign is all about.
Well, listen, David, we're way over time here. So thank you so much.
You talk too much.
I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope we get a chance to do it again.
Have a great week. Thank you very much, Mark. Be good.
All right. Thank you. Take care, David. Happy Canada Day.